Can you hear?
Can
you talk up a little?
I think you covered this. The question is whether we need a clarification of whether class court is subject to the jurisdiction of the district court.
What's your opinion?
I don't think so.
I think it's been briefed. We'll take care of it.
We're satisfied. Thank you for the offer. We will proceed to case number 3, please. The United States versus Tammy Singleton.
Good morning. My name is Gerald Berry. I represent Tammy Singleton. This case comes on appeal from the Southern District of Illinois. It involves Tammy Singleton and 5 co-defendants charged in a drug conspiracy case. If it pleases the court, I would like to proceed this morning and focus on the following points. Actually, questions to the court. How can the U.S. Attorney, first of all, justify a decision to prosecute a defendant when its presentation of evidence is entirely dependent upon the bargain for testimony of convicted alleged co-conspirators seeking a reduction in their sentences? The only independent evidence presented by the government in the prosecution of this case was that Tammy Singleton purchased a money counting machine. Tammy Singleton assisted Robert Howell in purchasing a truck. Tammy Singleton looked after his house in Martha while he was out of the city, and she leased a vehicle. None of these are criminal acts.
But Mr. Berry, you can't seriously argue that testimony from co-conspirators isn't perfectly good testimony. I mean, the federal reporters are packed with criminal cases where that's the evidence on which a jury relies, and if the jury decides to believe them, that's its prerogative.
Your Honor,
job of counsel during the trial is to cross-examine and bring these flaws out and try to cast doubt on credibility.
Your Honor, as pointed out there in the brief, there were a number of inconsistencies and glaring conflicts in the testimony between the 4 defendants with respect to...
Counsel, do you have any case law supporting your theory?
Your Honor, I do not. I would like the opportunity to file a post-argument memorandum.
Well, you knew that in advance, that you didn't have any case law.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, this argument about the different inconsistencies amongst the co-defendant's testimony, that was argued in closing argument, correct? That
yes.
was pointed out. Counsel had an opportunity to argue that, and the jury resolved that.
Your Honor, the opportunity was there, and I recognize the right of the jury to decide includes the right to decide incorrectly. We feel they decided incorrectly.
Incorrectly.
Yes,
but
Your Honor.
you named 4 different pieces of objective evidence, like purchasing that money counting machine and 3 or 4 things you admitted that your client did. And so it wasn't just the testimony of the co-defendant.
Well, Your Honor, the testimony of the co-defendants was inconsistent, and I believe that the credibility lent to their testimony by the U.S. Attorney's Office is what persuaded the jury to find against my client.
So you think the U.S. Attorney improperly made an improper argument to the jury?
I do, Your Honor.
And what was that improper argument?
The closing argument of the U.S. Attorney was that the co-defendants all testified truthfully. He asked the jury to disregard the fact that each of them were seeking a downward departure in exchange for their testimony. In fact, 2 of the co-defendants did obtain a downward departure. The other 2 defendants did not receive downward departures for their testimony. We attempted as best we could in our closing argument to point out the glaring inconsistencies between the various defendants' testimonies with respect to times, with respect to places, with respect to dollar amounts, with respect to drug quantities, with respect to identification of the defendant. Apparently, for whatever reason, the jury either could not or did not want to weigh the evidence in such a way as to give the benefit to the defendant. We do not believe the reasonable doubt standard was met. We do not believe there was a sufficient amount of evidence even to meet we do not believe the burden was met, Your Honor.
And you said in closing argument the prosecutor said that they should ignore the fact that the co-defendants might get a downward departure. Is that what you say? Are you? I'm not quite. Did you ask for a jury instruction saying that that was improper? I mean.
Well, we did not have a problem with the jury instructions and the closing argument of the. Well, not only in the closing argument, but during the course of the trial, there was, on direct examination and on cross-examination, significant questioning with respect to the fact that each of the co-defendants were providing testimony in exchange for their hopes of obtaining a downward departure. Each defendant made a statement to the effect that they were only coming to tell the truth, and the U.S. attorney led them in their testimony so they would say, I'm only here to tell the truth. However, I did have conversations with the U.S. attorney with the expectation or hope that I would receive a downward departure if I testified truthfully.
Mr. Berry, maybe you just should be clear. Were you trial counsel, or have you taken this over for the appeal?
I was co-counsel with Mr. Thomas Sims at trial. In addition, we feel that there were glaring inconsistencies with respect to the sentences given to the co-defendants. We have Tammy given a sentence of 292 months in prison, in spite of the fact that she had no prior felony convictions, and this is to be compared with Mr. Howell, who had numerous prior felony convictions, who was a principal conspirator, who admitted under oath having committed armed robbery and furtherance of the conspiracy. This is also compared with a sentence of 48 months given to a co-defendant who admitted having gone back and forth on many occasions delivering drugs, delivering money. Also with another co-defendant who admitted flying back and forth to Jamaica, Texas, and other locations, transporting kilograms of cocaine between the state of Illinois and Jamaica and other locations.
Did you cite any cases for us where that kind of disparity existed, where the court remanded, sent the cases back just because of the disparity alone?
I did not find any, Your Honor.
Okay.
Our position is that the present statutes with regard to drug conspiracy laws and sentencing guidelines allow so much leverage in the hands of the U.S. Attorney's Office, where the judge at the district court level is effectively handcuffed. We made our arguments in the district court. I truly believe that the judge in his heart did not want to impose the sentence, which he did. We made our motion for motion for judgment, notwithstanding the verdict, that was not denied. But going back to the beginning of the proceeding, at the initial arraignment, the information with regards to Tammy Singleton was that she had certain property in her name. The only property found to be in her name was a money counting machine that was found at a location in St. Louis, Missouri. There was no real estate. There was no evidence of drugs in her house. There was no evidence of money in her house. There was no evidence of any proceeds or enrichment to Tammy from this conspiracy. Each of the other parties were found with drugs, with money, with weapons.
Isn't that all a credibility determination for the jury counsel?
Again, Your Honor, I concur this case to be a turn on credibility. We were faced with a situation where, after having the motion for judge material denied, motion to disclose denied, motion to change the venue denied, raising questions about going to trial before a jury where the panel consisted of 35 Caucasian citizens and one black citizen. There was every reason for Tammy to take the deal. And this was talked we talked with her and we wrote her, both ourselves and Mr. Sims, advising her that given the circumstance, given the odds against her, it will probably be better to make the deal with the government, considering the sentences obtained by Kitty James and Michelle McGill. However, Tammy was convinced of her innocence, and her faith in God just told her, you know, this is something that will pass. This is something that I can bring to the court, for the truth will come out, and I will be free. We went there facing those odds, and the credibility came down to, it came down to the credibility issue. We feel that the circumstances were, I can put it in no other words, it was an ambush. Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Randy Massey. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represented the government at trial in this case, as well as here on appeal. This is a difficult argument to make in one sense, in that I don't even know where to start, given the brief that was filed in this case. Counsel argues that there was insufficient evidence to support the conviction in this case. I think in his brief, he says that the jurors were either too ignorant or too prejudiced to find reasonable doubt. But that allegation doesn't overcome the substantial evidence that was presented in this case to show that this defendant was guilty of the conspiracy with which he was charged. We presented evidence at trial that on at least one occasion this defendant personally delivered 20 kilograms of cocaine at the request of the leader of the conspiracy to a co-conspirator named Robert McCoy. We presented evidence that this defendant received, counted, and stored United States currency, which was the result of drug trafficking, a total of $5 or $6 million over the term of the conspiracy. We presented evidence that this defendant assisted other co-conspirators in the concealment of property that was gained through drug trafficking activities. We presented evidence that this defendant helped co-conspirators, and specifically Robert Howell, the leader of the conspiracy, to obtain false identification papers for one of the aliases that he used to further the drug conspiracy. We presented evidence that she purchased currency counters, that she paid for them with her credit card, that she had them shipped to her mailboxes, et cetera, box, for use in the conspiracy to count currency that was made. We recovered, although there was evidence presented that she purchased two of these currency counters, we recovered one in the execution of the search warrant at two properties in St. Louis that the Howell organization used for the distribution and storage of controlled substances. We traced that currency counter back to its serial number, to its purchaser, its source in California, and traced it through to being purchased on her credit card by this defendant. We presented evidence that she arranged for bail for co-conspirators when they were arrested on drug charges during the course of the conspiracy. We presented evidence that she personally picked up and couriered drug trafficking proceeds. She traveled to St. Louis and picked up in excess of $300,000. She traveled to Minneapolis and picked up, I think, approximately $25,000, which were drug proceeds developed by this conspiracy. We presented evidence that when other couriers brought money to be delivered to Howell, that she on many occasions received that currency and stored it for Howell. We presented evidence that when drugs were brought to Howell's headquarters in the Chicago area, that she helped store that cocaine and then distributed it to other members of the conspiracy when they came into town to pick up their share. The bottom line is that counsel is basically talking about evaluation of the evidence, and the jury made that evaluation. Now, counsel says there were inconsistencies in some of the testimony of the witnesses. That may be on minor points. I've never been in a trial where there were not minor inconsistencies between witnesses. It's the jury's responsibility to resolve those inconsistencies and to make factual findings. The jury did that in this case. But I need to point out, and I think it's very important to this court, that many of the things that counsel cites in his brief as inconsistencies are in fact not inconsistencies and are in fact not supported by the record. For example, counsel makes reference to picking up currency in, I believe, March of 1998 from a co-conspirator named James Daly. What counsel neglects to say, and what is not clear from his brief, is that the facts developed at trial show that there were, in fact, two instances at that same approximate time period where money was received from James Daly. One was received by Tammy Singleton at a shopping mall in St. Louis, where she accompanied Robert Howell and picked up approximately $300,000. Later in that month, after a quantity of marijuana had been delivered to the area, another co-conspirator, Anthony Howell, obtained approximately $300,000, or he thought slightly more, $320,000 to $360,000, from James Daly in East St. Louis at a house that was being renovated at the time that he met with Mr. Daly there. So we don't have inconsistencies in the testimony. We have witnesses talking about two different instances. Counsel also says, for example, on pages 9 and 10 of his brief, the evidence was that the defendant knew nothing about the drug conspiracy until March of 1998 when Robert Howell called her from Texas. The evidence was she later went to Texas. And counsel cites page 66 of the March 7, 2001 transcript in support of that allegation. But if the court would look at the pages preceding that page, beginning at approximately page 63 of that transcript, the court will see that Robert Howell was not being cross-examined about the defendant's knowledge of the conspiracy. Robert Howell was being cross-examined about the defendant's knowledge of an arrest of a co-conspirator named Patrice Murphy. Patrice Murphy had been arrested in Texas while she was in the process of currying drugs for the Robert Howell organization at approximately that time period. Mr. Howell and Tammy Singleton went to Texas at that same time, happened to catch the Final Four, or at least some portion of the NCAA tournament, and also did some business when they were in Texas. Mr. Howell was being asked about when this defendant found out, or if she found out, about the arrest of Patrice Murphy. He was not testifying about her knowledge of the conspiracy. And so counsel has taken bits and pieces from the record which do not accurately reflect what was actually happening in that trial and what evidence was actually presented in that trial. He combines two instances into one. He refers to things differently than the questions that were asked at trial. And so the bottom line on sufficiency of the evidence is that it's the jury's determination to determine the facts in this case. And there was certainly sufficient evidence in this case to allow the jury to find that this defendant was guilty of the conspiracy with which she was charged. Counsel also argues that error was made in the imposition of the sentence in this case. Your Honor, Judge Herndon was very conservative in the sentencing determination that he made. The testimony at trial was clearly that this conspiracy involved well in excess of 1,000 kilograms of cocaine that was distributed and also a substantial quantity of marijuana. I believe at least several hundreds of pounds of marijuana. The court based its decision on sentencing on two factors: relevant conduct with respect to the amount of controlled substance for which the defendant was responsible, or I should say, which was reasonably foreseeable to this defendant, and enhancing that or adding to that a two-level increase for her commission of perjury during her testimony at trial. Those were the only factors that affected the offense level in this case. Defendant's brief refers to enhancements for gun. There was no enhancement for gun in this case. The sentence is based on a level 38, based on relevant conduct with a two-level enhancement for perjury during the defendant's testimony.
What was the guideline range on the sentence? I know the court imposed the 292, but what was the range?
The guideline range was 292 to 300, and I forget the exact top of the range.
360.
360.
I know the top.
Okay.
The
defendant was sentenced to the low end of the range determined by the court. And counsel has presented nothing in his brief to show that the court was in error in its determination of relevant conduct, or to show that the court was in error when it determined that this defendant obstructed justice by committing perjury during her testimony. And the court was very clear on those findings. He stated the reasons for those findings. He was very conservative in his calculation of relevant conduct. Quite honestly, I think this defendant's relevant conduct was substantially more than the court found. That's a moot point at this time since it was a level 38 anyway. But the court was very conservative when he converted the currency that was counted into the drugs that that represented. And he was conservative in doing that because he attributed 100% of the marijuana for which this conspiracy was responsible as being represented in the currency that was counted. That results in a lower sentencing range than would have had if he had used cocaine for 100% of the currency that was counted.
Right.
But based upon the evidence in this case, this defendant was responsible for a whole lot more. And not only did she handle the money, she handled the drugs, she handled the fake ID, she handled the bond when that was necessary for members of this conspiracy. Counsel has also raised other issues in his brief, which we've tried to address in our brief. We think we've done that adequately. Unless there are any specific questions about those other issues, I will thank the court and ask you to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, sir.
With all due respect, counsel, my recollection of the testimony at the trial was somewhat different. with respect to the comments regarding delivery of controlled substances to Robert McCoy, we did attempt to subpoena Robert McCoy and have him present at the trial. For some reason, he was in federal custody. He was not made available. The only information or evidence given with respect to a delivery of controlled substances to Robert McCoy by Tommy Singleton was testimony given by one of the Howell brothers. With regards to the testimony as to how much money was earned by the conspiracy, again, we are relying entirely upon the testimony of the Howell brothers, and both of whom like to brag quite a bit and make themselves out to be more than the petty thugs that they were. So counsel's reliance upon their testimony with regards to quantities of drugs and amounts of money earned did result in a higher standard that should have been involved in the sentencing considerations. With respect to issues of property or concealment of property, there was no evidence presented that Tammy concealed any property. With the purchase of the truck, she had funds wired from her bank here in Chicago. With respect to the money counting machines, that was placed on her credit card, so there was no effort at concealment. Again, the testimony from Mr. Howell with regards to the false IDs, they had the opportunity to bring in persons from Social Security Administration or wherever the fake IDs were obtained. The government did not do so. There was nothing to corroborate the testimony of the co-defendants. I do not recall Tammy having arranged bail for any of the co-conspirators. I may be incorrect, but the record will bear out where bail was provided by Tammy Singleton. In going through the transcripts of the hearings from March 5th through the sentencing hearing, I tried as best as I could to point out the inconsistencies in the testimony of the defendants. I have no doubt in my mind that the mantle of credibility was placed upon their shoulders by the U.S. Attorney's Office. My concern is that given the present situation, the U.S. Attorney's Office has abused its discretion in the prosecution of my client. I thank the court for the time this morning. God be with you.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement and proceed.